Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 5, 2010, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. There's no issue today that we ever talk about on this program or that one hears about in the news that doesn't involve some sort of public relations, some sort of spin. Oftentimes, it plays an enormous role on the central issues dealing with war and peace, the environment, the economy. Today, we're going to have an expert on the subject of public relations and spin, the head of the leading group that works to expose it. Join us today for Media Matters, but first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
The fight over the future of the internet is coming to a head. FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski announced that the agency would finally seek a vote at the end of December on net neutrality, the principle that ensures that internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon treat all internet traffic, applications, and services equally. But based on the chairman's preview of the agency's proposed rules, his net neutrality looks nothing like real net neutrality at all. Chris Riley is policy counsel for Free Press. He says that based on the current understanding of what is in the order, details of which have not been made public yet, the rulemaking falls short in several major areas, and it didn't address the looming question of reclassifying broadband under Title II of the Communications Act, leaving the FCC's jurisdiction over broadband on shaky legal ground.
Our position is and has been that adopting net neutrality rules under any theory other than reclassification creates a huge unnecessary risk for the legal viability of the rules. And we continue to believe that not reclassifying is a mistake for the commission.
The draft appears to have no ban on paid prioritization, another major problem area. Paid prioritization allows internet service providers to erect toll booths on the web and charge users to speed up content while slowing down everyone else.
The internet is what it is today because it has been an open and level playing field where new small garage startups can come in with a good idea and make it. They can compete on an even playing field with the Microsofts and the Googles of the world. And if paid prioritization is allowed to exist on open internet, it will risk ending that. Because suddenly, Google doesn't have to innovate anymore. They can just buy priority and squeeze out all of their would-be competitors that way.
It also appears to include significant loopholes that could create an environment where internet service providers can establish fast and slow lanes for the services and applications of their choice, and offers little to no protections on wireless access at all.
I think at the end of the day, the question that the FCC should be thinking about is whether they're going to do real or fake net neutrality. For us, it's not net neutrality unless it includes rules against paid prioritization, unless it applies to wireless networks on the same basis as wired, and unless it has clear lines in the sand that make sure that these rules cover all internet access services and don't leave giant gaping loopholes for other types of specialized or managed services. So for us, the bottom line is make it real. Do net neutrality the right way. Don't put out some fake compromise that doesn't actually protect consumers and doesn't actually preserve innovation on the open internet.
The agency will vote on the issue at their December 21st meeting. To learn more, visit savetheinternet.com.
In 2009, the shooting of Oscar Grant, an unarmed 22-year-old African-American killed by a white police officer in Oakland, California, motivated dozens of artists to speak out and sparked a police accountability movement across the country. Through music videos, audio links, and blog posts, artists turned to the internet to express their outrage, sadness, and concern for their community. Eric Arnold, an internet reporting fellow with the G.W. Williams Center for Independent Journalism, and who wrote an investigative series on net neutrality's impact on artists and communities, said it was the open internet that provided local artists with the venue to speak out when the mainstream media remained quiet after the shooting.
These were all very expressive critiques of the system, of police brutality, of racism, of all of these things that anger people on a community level, but really don't get a whole lot of attention on a mainstream level. All of these tributes to Oscar Grant were released through the internet. It was something that would not have been possible on commercial radio. And really, if the internet was blocked, we would just have music that doesn't even go into issues of this kind.
With a consolidated mainstream media system that often ignores local voices, Arnold worries that artists' attempts to vocalize the issues in their communities will be lost if we lose net neutrality.
Without net neutrality, or if net neutrality is threatened and not upheld, that level of artistic expression could completely disappear. And once again, we'd be looking at a situation with where consolidation has now taken hold of an art form.
To read his series on net neutrality, visit newamericamedia.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Today, the topic is public relations, spin, especially used by corporations, sometimes used by governments, but seemingly omnipresent in American politics and almost impossible to get to the bottom of. So today we have as our guest the executive director of a group that was created just to do that, the Center for Media and Democracy, based in Madison, Wisconsin. And our guest is the executive director of the center, Lisa Graves. Lisa, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
It's my great pleasure. First of all, let's talk a little bit about what the Center for Media and Democracy does what its history is and what sort of work you guys do to give our listeners a sense of what's up.
Sure. We fight spin. We've been fighting spin for about 16 years. CMD is a national organization. We've got three websites, sourcewatch.org, prwatch.org, and BanksterUSA. That's banker plus gangster equals BanksterUSA.org. And these sites are really dedicated to outing corporate front groups, outing corporate spin, outing propaganda, and trying to get the truth out to people. And so the issues that we cover include the environment, healthcare reform, financial reform, the whole issue of democracy and the corporate takeover of our democracy, and a variety of issues, including tobacco, and particular issues on the environment, including coal, petroleum, gas drilling, and those sorts of things. So we cover basically almost any issue that affects your daily life, from the economy to your health to the environment.
So basically, Lisa Graves, the idea is that you guys do research and information and make it available to citizens and journalists and activists who want to sort of figure out who's involved here and what they're up to?
That's exactly right. You know, there's a lot of information out on the web about who's funding what or what one group says or what money they donated to a particular campaign or where they've lobbied. But there aren't a lot of places where you can go and find kind of a dossier on some of these organizations or some of these corporations. And so on sourcewatch.org, we have a collaborative wiki. It's a specialized encyclopedia that allows people to help us write history, help us write the history of the groups and companies that are trying to shape public policy. And so we're in the process of expanding some of those articles to make sure that we document CEO pay and bonuses, corporate profits, corporate spending on lobbying, corporate spending on PR, violations of the law in the environmental area and otherwise, and how they're attempting to distort public policy and undermine the American dream.
Well, Lisa Graves, our guest today, the head of the Center for Media and Democracy, you've just been talking about it. Let's go through some of the case studies of the work you're doing before we go to callers. I think probably the case that has given the Center for Media and Democracy the most recognition in the last couple of years has been healthcare and the debates over healthcare. And Wendell Potter, who's gained some notoriety as the former Cigna executive, who became a leading critic of the public relations work of the health insurance industry over the last few years, is connected to the center, works with the center, has been on your staff now for a couple of years. Talk a little bit about, the role of spin in something like healthcare and what the center did to help citizens navigate through it and understand it.
Sure. Well, we were very fortunate last year that Wendell Potter decided to come fight spin with us. He had been a PR exec for the insurance industry and had tremendous regrets about helping the insurance industry fight the last round of healthcare reform and also fight against Michael Moore and his movie Sicko. And so Wendell came to us because he wanted to help get the word out about insurance industry misinformation. And so for the last year and a half, Wendell and CMD have been working to reach out to citizens across the country, talking to people across the country, meeting members of Congress and others to talk about how the insurance company is distorting the picture, insurance industries are distorting the picture. And Wendell has a new book out called Deadly Spin that documents these fights, both his fight in this past year for health reform, for some of the progressive gains that were in that compromise bill, and also his efforts overall to help with the next stage of healthcare reform on the implementation, which is where there's an awful lot of pushing and shoving by the insurance industry to try to take back even the few major improvements that we got in that legislation. So Wendell's been working hard on that, and the center has been working to make sure people know about the spin. The death panel spin was one area where it was shocking.
Let's back up here and go through this a little bit, because I think a lot of our listeners have heard about spin, but they don't really know what it is, means exactly. It's not like this is something that's talked about in the conventional news media a great deal, at least in the sense you're covering it. In the case of the healthcare debates, Lisa Grace, what are some examples of how the industry, what it did to try to shape the debate and maybe distort the debate in a way that served their interest?
Well, the industry, one of the things the industry did was help financially support front groups, groups that basically look like they're just ordinary citizens standing up, speaking out, but really are largely funded by big corporations. And so one of the major groups that industry has funded and other businesses have funded is FreedomWorks. FreedomWorks has been very active in this debate. It's led by Dick Armey, the former Republican House leader from Texas. And FreedomWorks has been pushing a lot of misinformation about the current state of healthcare, including the death panels issue. So,
and the death panels issue what was that all about?
That was an issue in which there were claims that the healthcare bill would create so-called death panels to decide whether someone got end-of-life care or not. In fact, that provision was one that was proposed, the underlying provision was one that was proposed on a bipartisan basis to ensure that family medical consultations with doctors when their loved one was dying would be covered by health insurance payments, that it wouldn't be denied coverage. Mm. And instead, that was distorted by Sarah Palin, by FreedomWorks and others to really suggest that the government wanted to engage in death panels. The bottom line is that the insurance industry itself is filled with death panels. The for-profit insurance industry has people dedicated to finding ways to deny your family members coverage, to kick people off the rolls when they're sick, and to basically pay as little as possible out. And so Wendell has helped blow the whistle on those practices and has also talked about how the profit motive in the insurance industry has really gone to the detriment of many Americans.
Now, when the Center for Media and Democracy or Wendell Potter or both of you combined does an expose on something like FreedomWorks and on issues like death panel, what is the risk? Do you take this to journalists at the New York Times and the Washington Post and CBS News and CNN and even Fox News? And if you do, what sort of response do you generally get? Or did you get in this specific case, I should say?
Well, we do reach out to media mostly through personal relationships with reporters. And in this case, I would say that the most robust coverage of the issue came from MSNBC. From Keith Oberman, from Rachel Maddow, from others who really, The Edge Show, who really kept an eye on this issue. They were the among the mainstream journalist organizations, among the mainstream corporate media. MSNBC was by far, I think, the strongest and most credible, most skeptical of the claims being being funded by industry and by these front groups and by extremists like Sarah Palin.
Well, Wendell Potter was on MSNBC quite often as an expert commentator, Was he ever an expert commentator on any of these other channels, do you know?
He was. Actually, Wendell has managed to appear on almost every one of the major the major media shows, CBS, ABC, even Fox. So he has done a lot of media, but a lot of those pieces are, you know, 30-second spots, or maybe it's a one-minute spot, or it's a five-minute profile. But MSNBC really created a forum to have a dialogue, to have a real conversation about what the bill was about, besides just a soundbite, which kind of goes back to your question about spin. What's happened in this media climate with the corporate consolidation of media, with so many reporters from the print publications losing their jobs with consolidation, is that there are far fewer reporters who are actually investigating what's happening in our country. And they have far bigger beats to cover, and often they have less experience. And the result of that, as you've documented, Bob, in your book and elsewhere, is that reporters tend to rely on press releases, on sound bites. And then the people get a story of he said, she said. One sound bite in 30 seconds says this. Another sound bite says that. Who knows what the answer is?
How, Lisa Graves, would you grade the news media coverage of the debate over health care, you know, throughout 2009 and into 2010 as the bill was being drafted, debated, discussed, and eventually voted upon by Congress and signed into law? I mean, as you look, stand back now and look at the quality of the immense amount of press coverage it got, because it was a big news story. This wasn't the sort of story the news media just missed. They were on it. They had their top reporters on it. This was being covered. It was understood as the most important domestic political issue in the country for a good year. And as you look at that, it's a good way to evaluate our news media and what a job they do when they really got one teed up in the middle of the plate, take a swing at it, guys. What grade would you give them?
I don't know. I really think I'd give him a C or D, quite frankly.
Now,
Bob.
Is that on a curve, or well, how hard a grader are you, Grace?
That's a good question. I might be a hard grader, actually, but I think that's a fair grade. They definitely did put a lot of time and resources, in essence, into reporting on healthcare coverage. But even that reporting, I think, was very shallow. Very shallow. And I think it was it involved a lot of reporting about sort of the claims of distortions without piercing through those distortions.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the success of good public relations by the health insurance industry or its supporters is not necessarily that everyone agrees completely with everything they say, as much as if they set what everyone's talking about, they're just debating death panels for three months,
right,
or some ridiculous thing like that, then they've won.
Right.
You aren't actually debating the actual issue.
Right. I think that's right. I think a couple of factors. One is that the coverage seems to be more ubiquitous. You have the feeling, the sensation of having a more news coverage, but what you have is kind of more quantity and not more quality. And then you just have the repetition and sort of obsessive focus on a couple of issues to the detriment of everything else. And those issues that they spend a lot of time on tend to be sort of things where there's a lot of high rhetoric, a lot of rhetoric about, a lot of conflict about, and not a lot of kind of really telling the truth about. There's this notion of sort of balance. One side says this, another side says that, without actually doing the work to show which side is right.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, is Lisa Graves, who is the executive director for the Center for Media and Democracy, which is based in Madison. It's a nationwide organization which works on exposing spin and public relations campaigns that distort and pollute our political environment and our media. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Lisa Graves here at Media Matters, the phone number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a battery of issues to talk about that the center is working on, many of which I know are of great concern to our listeners. Let's talk a little more on the health thing and Wendell Potter with his new book out, because this was such a big issue, and the center was right involved in the heart of trying to expose some of the spin and the public relations going on. Wendell Potter has been, I mean, the work that the center does and that Wendell's done on this was very critical of the public relations industry for its role in participating in, you know, lowering the intelligence, not raising the understanding of the issue. How has the PR industry responded to your work in this area?
Well, they haven't been happy, but I take that as a badge of honor. The PR industry has, it kind of vacillates between trying to ignore what we're saying and then responding and attempting to claim that they're just interested in the truth. So there was actually an op-ed recently by Richard Edelman, the head of the Edelman PR firm.
Which is one of the biggies, right?
One of the real big PR firms in the country and really globally, saying that Wendell Potter had no right to suggest that the PR industry had a reputation for distortion, had no right to suggest that people in the PR industry have done anything wrong, and that they were just, quote, interested in the truth and educating stakeholders, which actually was interesting coming from Edelman, because Edelman, the firm, made its fortune in the tobacco fight, basically trying to discredit people who said that smoking caused cancer, trying to spin and suggest that there were other other issues with cancer besides cigarettes.
Well, also, I mean, they're positive. It helps the overpopulation problem, I guess. You could look at it that way. I mean,
one of the things,
I don't know if they went that route.
No,
that's a little touchy.
They didn't quite go that route, but they really really fought hard against smoking bans in public places and in airplanes and other places, and really fought against any acknowledgement of the effects of secondhand smoking. They made their money on big tobacco. Now, since then, they
so
have stopped.
Not necessarily
running
on the ethical high ground. Is that what you're trying to suggest, Lisa Grace?
It is. It is. Now, to be fair to Edelman, they stopped taking tobacco money once the tobacco settlement was entered into. I guess there's a lot less tobacco money for them to get at that point.
Yeah.
But they stopped taking tobacco money at that point, and so they claim that they now have clean hands after 40-plus years of pretty dirty hands.
You know what's interesting about that, just to get in on this, I suspect almost none of our listeners are familiar with Edelman, or was it Burston Marsteller,
right.
And there's a couple of other of these PR groups that dominate the industry, but they're almost entirely unknown to the general public. It's really interesting. I don't think there's any other major industry in our economy where it's almost like they're in a corporate witness protection program. You never know who these guys are, because that's how PR is supposed to be, right? Isn't that that's the whole business model?
Right. That's the business model, is that they don't want their name to be associated with the feel-good images or feel-good names of some of these groups that have been created, like Freedom Works or others. They want to be behind the scenes and pretend like these things are just the truth coming down from on high, or great glossy sort of ad campaigns, or you know, talking points that have been vetted through focus groups and through polling, and really shaped and contorted to push people's buttons without them being the ones that you see behind the scenes pushing your button.
Our guest again, Lisa Grace from the Center for Media and Democracy, the PR Watch group that monitors corporate spin on crucial political issues of our time. This is a live show of Media Matters coming to you over WILL AM 580. So we are taking callers at 333-9455 or our toll-free line at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now to our first caller. Line one, Champaign County, you're on the air with Lisa Graves.
Hi. In your last remark there, you emphasized corporate spin, but earlier it was talked about government spin as well. And I know that some of the founding people and friends of y'all wrote the book Weapons of Mass Deception and were really focused on government lying. And frankly, I think there's a lot of government misrepresentation and spin about Pakistan, FPAC, and the whole mess. And I know you guys are really busy with the myriad of projects you've already outlined, but it seems to me that there also should be a focus on government misrepresentation and Pentagon excesses, and there are other groups that do that, like FAIR and Public Accuracy, etc. But I'm wondering whether any of your old stalwarts, the people whose names I can't remember, who
John Stauber, is I think you're thinking right. of specifically.
Right. But the other thing is more in line of what you were actually talking about is this: all of this activity, too, or most of this activity, is tax deductible, the cost of doing business. And every now and then you hear about attempts to rein in corporations by limiting the tax deductibility of certain things. When they're spending so much money you know, lying and misrepresenting, is it possible to offer that as a strategy of saying, well, when the amount of money that the companies are paying, are spending on advertising and PR, if that were to be limited, at least I guess we could say that, well, we're at least taxpayers aren't in a backhanded way paying for our own deception. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Great, great question, by the way, I thought. I'm not in the habit of grading my caller's questions, but I would give that one an A.
I agree. Those were really thoughtful points.
Well, why don't you want to start with the issue of government spin?
Sure. Sure. Well, that is something that we're focused on as well. The center does report on government spin. We have a number of pieces that we've done in PR Watch and also on Source Watch, as well as Bankster USA, about the economy, about environmental issues. We did a lot of reporting on the use of the, quote, dispersants in the BP oil situation and the claims by the government and agencies that all was well, that all the oil was miraculously gone. We've been fighting distortions in the financial reform issues from Tim Geithner and others from Wall Street as well, about the state of the bailout, how much money was really at risk and put forward, both through the TARP bailout as well as through the Federal Reserve. We fought for that Federal Reserve audit that just came out. I actually have a background on the national security issues, and so it's a particular interest of mine, the gap between what's said publicly about our foreign policy and domestic policy in terms of national security policies and what the truth is.
Just to interrupt you on that point, Lisa, because I know in your email to me before the show, you mentioned that the whole WikiLeaks incident, which has sort of taken the world by storm in the last week or so, that this is something that you're interested in. How is that?
Well, we're still poring over what has been released, and that's an issue where you have a lot of stories being told about what's been happening in Pakistan, as you mentioned, what's been happening in Afghanistan, what the truth has been on the ground versus the media coverage about it.
So this is a treasure trove of BS.
It's a treasure trove that in many ways documents some of the things that the alternative press has been saying about the coverage by the mainstream media, where the mainstream media has tended to report whatever the Pentagon says is the state of play. The alternative press has been pushing for more information about what's really happening. Are we, quote, winning? Are we losing? What's the effect of this foreign policy in terms of putting wind in the sails of the nation's enemies?
Mm-hmm.
What's the effect of these drone bombings that are supposedly so surgical, but they end up taking out innocent civilians? And so there's a lot there to review. And there are also some complicated issues in terms of some of the classification of the documents at issue. I know that there's been a lot of reporting about the parallels between this release and the Pentagon Papers. And so it's something we're taking a hard look at. What are the truths that come out of this sort of revelation of government activities and this sort of revelation about what the CIA and other agencies have been up to without much consent by the American people?
And the second part of the question that the caller had really gets to an issue that I think is, whenever I teach public relations in my classes, which I do frequently, the students say, well, what can we do about it? I mean, okay, we see these powerful institutions are, you know, manipulating journalism, they're planting bogus stories, they're basically warping our ability to effectively understand the world, to engage in self-government. Are we powerless? What is your answer to that when people ask you that question?
Well, I would say we fundamentally aren't powerless. In some ways, you know.
And where does tax deductibility come in to get to the caller's question? That was a lead into that question.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that I do think that at least for a window here, and there was a brief mention about the net neutrality issue before this segment started. But in this certain moment with the internet, there is a lot more accessibility and possibility to share information about what's happening and to have some reporting that isn't just what's reporting by the mainstream media or just PR spin. And so there's a lot more accessibility and availability now of information that you might not have had before. They've been much harder to get before the advent of the internet. At the same time, that's no panacea, and we've got a lot of work ahead of us. We've got our work cut out for us in terms of pushing back and trying to get people educated about these issues. And I think, you know, fundamentally, one of the things is really, this is going to sound like a maybe too Pollyanna, but it's really a lot about heart-to-heart dialogue with our neighbors, with the people we work with our friends, about what's gone wrong in our economy, what's happening, you know, from a real-world standpoint in our lives. How does healthcare insurance policies and practices really affect us? We all know people who've been hurt by the economic policies that have been advanced by Wall Street. We all know people who've been hurt by the insurance industry's fixation on profit to the detriment of all else. And so, you know, it really is about, in many ways, telling these stories, documenting these stories, getting the word out, and really transforming our society in sort of one person at a time.
Well, what about the idea that the caller had, which is to, and this has been talked about, I know, with advertising historically. This has been a hot-button issue for the advertising industry. And what about the idea of saying to corporations, your PR work, your along these lines, is no longer a tax-deductible expense? You know, it goes in with your, on the profit side of the ledger, not the expense side of the ledger, and is subject to what remains of corporate taxation in the United States?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I have to say that the tax policy question, as framed by the caller, was, you know, really fascinating in terms of the fact that all this spending, for the most part, is pre-tax. So when you look at these corporations that are reporting these $1 billion in profits, that's after they've spent millions and millions of dollars on PR spend.
Do we know how much is spent on PR by corporations or government in a year? Because I don't know. I'd be interested to know if you have any idea.
No, I don't. I read a lot of the publications that talk about sort of the big firms, what their big earnings are. But there is, I don't think there's any source that actually documents how much, and even how much the government is spending on PR through the Pentagon PR operation. That's got to be huge.
And it is sort of murky because for advertising, we know to the penny what businesses and government spends on advertising. This is all right out there information. Everyone knows to a penny what's spent on it nationally and internationally. If for PR, we don't even know what a single firm spends on it. Or the government, we try to figure out what the government's spending on PR, like at the Pentagon, where they have hundreds and thousands of people who do nothing but PR. But it's the way it's buried in these budgets, you can barely tease it out and find out what actually our tax dollars are doing.
It's really hard. And then beyond that, what's happened is this real emergence of these nonprofit groups, these groups that have pay no taxes under Part 501c3, c4, c5 of the Internal Revenue Code, although maybe some small amount for certain really limited categories of activity. But you have a bunch of 501c3 organizations, which are like FreedomWorks and others, that are receiving corporate profits. The corporations are basically getting tax write-offs for making donations to these groups.
To these front groups.
These front groups are working quite closely.
You know, if there's any prospective PhD student out there is a great dissertation in what we've just been trying, the question we've been trying to answer right here, and a great study to be done on that, an empirical study. But that's another matter.
Okay.
Our guest today, Lisa Grave, head of the Center for Media and Democracy, the executive director, the PR Watch group that also operates the website sourcewatch.org, and which is doing a lot of the work exposing spin and PR in the American news media and in American politics. The number here, if you'd like to call in, is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers who've been very patient. Let's go to them right now. Let's start with line 2, Sullivan, Illinois. You're on the air with Lisa Graves.
Hi. Thank you for taking my phone call. First of all, I want to say that I very much appreciate the work that you and your organization are doing, and I agree completely that it's work that needs to be done. Unfortunately, it appears to me, at least from my vantage point, that most of the folks in the communities and in the nation don't have access to it. It has to be something that someone's interested in and goes out and looks for. And the last caller touched on basically the subject of my phone call, which is, you know, the bigger picture. What do we do about this? And how do we get beyond this? And how do we take back sort of our government and our politicians and get corporations to respond to what citizens would like to have them doing? And I agree with you that MSNBC throughout the last election cycle and throughout the debate on some of the bigger issues facing our country has been, in my opinion, largely unbiased and credible. And I think you mentioned Keith Olbermann, and I do recall in the discussion of death panels how he was able to poke holes in that spin by bringing the case of his own, I think it was his father who was dying, and the fact that they were able to have dialogue with the doctor and that the insurance company was funding those visits with the doctor. And that is what, in fact, the other side was referring to as death panel. So I think that he used his own experience to point out to the viewers the fallacy in that presumption or in that that dialogue that the that was being... Okay. But the other thing is, and again, back to the bigger question, which you did touch on, it, what do we do about it? And, you know, the other thing that occurs to me and has occurred to me is that the discussion so much, and this is more about politicians and government, not so much corporations, even with Chuck Todd and Savannah White, whom I think are also unbiased, but I noticed in the discussion of the health care bill, when media was discussing it and journalists were discussing it and the debate was going on, they were talking about how politicians were going to vote and why they were going to vote that way because of what it was going to do, help or hurt them in the next election. And I just found it very ironic as I listened to a lot of these discussions going on that no one was talking about the merits of the health care bill and the merits of why one should vote one way. Every discussion was being had about how this would help or hurt them in the next election, and it seems to even be lost on everyone that the reason that we send folks to Congress and send folks to Washington, D.C. is to carry forward our interests, and no one was talking about how they personally felt because of the way that their constituents felt about the health care bill. And when we've gotten to that point, that that's the way that the debate has deteriorated and that no one even notices that we're not talking during the debate about the merits of the bill, but more about the outcome of the next election because of the way that the votes will go, how do we get moved back from that? How do we move back to where the politicians are accountable to the citizens? Because, and I hate to sound like a cynic, I don't like the callers that call in are just very cynical, but, you know, it appears to me and the experiences that I've witnessed, you know, the majority of politicians' constituents can be, for instance, against a particular bill. But if the corporations that are funding the campaigns of that politician are in favor of it, that's how the politician is going to vote. And it's very unlikely that then when it comes time to the next election cycle is that politician held accountable because of spend, because they're able to spend the vote. And by that time, of course, some folks have amnesia and many other things have happened. So I've talked a lot. I'll hang up and I'll let you talk. But I think the bigger question is, how do we not only stop the corporations from using so much spend, but get the politicians to be more accountable? And I that probably comes down to campaign finance reform and maybe term limits, and maybe that's the short answer to that. But I'll just hang up, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, thank you very much, Sullivan, Illinois. You know, maybe let me leapfrog or jump on top of that question and push it along, because one of the areas that you've been very active in, Lisa Graves, has been, and one of the areas that the Center for Media and Democracy is active in now and is increasing its work in, is this whole question of the power of corporations and their legal status. And coming off of the Citizens United case in January, which is in the process of sort of changing the way electoral politics play out in this country, and I think this is really very much what the caller was getting at. Maybe just take a second and give a little background for some of our listeners who have heard about this Citizens United thing and sort of vaguely know that this is sort of changing things, but don't really know much about it because, frankly, it's getting no coverage in the news media. So how would they know about it? So explain a little bit what's going on there and what your work and what the center's work is on this area, what your interest is in it.
Sure. Well, the Citizens United case is a case that was decided by the Supreme Court almost a year ago in January.
And we should point out, you are a lawyer. You're a practicing attorney, so you know a little bit about this is an issue you've worked in, too.
Well, I'm not practicing here in Wisconsin, but I did train as a lawyer, and I am formally served as the Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department and formerly the Chief Counsel for nominations for the United States Senate Judiciary Committee and other posts. But this is an issue where the Supreme Court of the United States issued a decision in January of this year, basically saying that corporations had a right constitutionally to spend unlimited money influencing our elections and our policies. That decision was a 5-4 decision. It was five guys in the majority, all of whom were appointed by Republican presidents, and who basically came to the court, in my view, with an agenda of advancing corporate power. Those judges, those five guys, include Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, Justice Roberts, and Justice Alito, the last two of whom were appointed by President George W. Bush, and also Justice Kennedy, who was a Reagan appointee. So this is part of the corporate agenda, this decision. And interestingly enough, it wasn't always that way, and it doesn't have to be partisan. It's a case where Justice John Paul Stevens, who recently retired from the court, who was appointed by President Ford, who was not an extremist president, who was a sort of moderate Republican, appointed Justice Stevens. Justice Stevens said, if the American people, basically I'm paraphrasing here, if the American people look at what's wrong with their political system, not having enough money in elections isn't one of the things that's wrong with our political system. If you look at what's happening in our society, corporations are not a disfavored class, despite the majority's claim that they're just a poor, beleaguered minority who can't get their voice heard unless they can spend unlimited money in our elections. It's really a decision that's out of whack. I think it's a radical decision. It's a decision that's hurting our democracy, and it's a decision that we as citizens have to stand up against. It seems daunting, as the caller said. It seems like how do you deal with this excessive corporate influence? The fact that it seems like some of the representatives in Congress represent corporations, not people. And it seems like at the time of the elections, people are being bombarded with more corporate advertising, distorting issues, focusing on the deficit, blaming the Democrats on the deficit that was initiated by George W. Bush after a surplus by the last Democrat in office, President Clinton. And you think it's easy to feel hopeless in response to this amount of spin. But if we feel hopeless, they win. You know, the fact is that this is a major, this is going to be a major challenge for all of us for the next generation, basically. This is likely to be a generation-long fight to push back on the excessive corporate control in our democracy and the policies that are really undermining our economy, whether it's the trade policy, whether it's the idea, the absurd idea that only millionaires can create jobs. Everyone who's taken a basic economics class knows that basically it's about demand and supply. And if there's demand and the capacity for ordinary people to spend money, jobs will be created. Jobs will be created by entrepreneurs who are trying to fill needs of the American people who have money to spend in their pockets. People like Carly Fiorina, who ran for the Senate in California, made her fortune. She's a multi-millionaire. She made her fortune cutting jobs. She's not a millionaire who created jobs by getting tax breaks as a millionaire. It's just not the way the world works. But that's the lie we've been hearing over and over and over in this election cycle, that basically we need tax cuts for the rich because only the rich can create jobs. That's not how America was built. America was built by ordinary entrepreneurs striking out and filling the needs of the American people and of our, you know, our society, our economy. And we need to have the American people basically have a conversation with each other about what's going on in our country, in our society, and stand up to the corporations. So, you know, we're spearheading an effort. We talk about it on sourcewatch.org. We talk about it across the country for people to stand up and take back our democracy, stand up to corporate rule, in essence. And the only way we're going to win this fight is if we start one step at a time to speaking out and standing up.
Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, is Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. We have a caller who's been waiting very patiently in our toll-free lines. Let's go to that caller right now. Line 4, Goodfield, Illinois. You're on the air with Lisa Graves.
Hi, and I would also like to say first thank you to Lisa and the Center for Media and Democracy for the work you're doing. My question is mostly on if your organization addresses the spin that corporate agribusiness tends to put out, like you said, lies that we hear over and over and over again. And I don't know if you would like to comment on any of those. One that's close to my heart is the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, which I think is an important common sense thing that has not been able to be passed by the legislature in Washington because of the pork producers and others who give us lies that the subtherapeutic use of antibiotics is not a problem, whereas it is a huge public health disaster that's actually happening right now. That's just one case, and I didn't know if you wanted to address any other instances of the large corporate agribusiness spinning and influencing what people think.
Well, thank you very much, caller, for your call. Lisa Grace, the Center for Media and Democracy, spin PR Watch, what about those issues? Do you go after them?
Absolutely. We think that the agribusiness issue is one of the biggest issues. In fact, the center was founded in part in response to PR spin campaigns by Monsanto. So this is part of our blood.
For the genetic modification of food.
For the genetic modification of food, and also for the types of industrial fertilizers that they were putting out there. So our core work in terms of our history, it has been standing up to agribusiness. And there's a lot going on in the antibiotic issue where there's just enormous misinformation, as the caller points out. We've seen, for example, in one of the issues we're covering, toxic sludge, which is sewage sludge that's being used, applied to agricultural land that isn't organic farming.
Now, so, what is sludge exactly? Because we hear that term. Is it just like, mud or what?
Sure. So there's a common use of the term sludge, which is kind of any sort of
gunky stuff.
Yeah, but then there's a term that we've coined, in essence, from the book Toxic Sludge is Good for You, that is sewage sludge. And sewage sludge is both human waste and also industrial waste that's poured down the drains. And then the sewage treatment plants treat it in order to clean the water that comes out of the sewage sludge plant. But the sewage sludge industry has been basically renaming sewage sludge as, quote, biosolids, and selling it to agribusiness to apply to fields around the country to grow our food in. And that sludge is not the same as manure. That sludge has heavy metals in it. It has flame retardants in it. It has antibiotics and other medical residues in it, both from agribusiness and from human beings. And then that's reapplied to crops across the country that are used both for animal use and for human use. And so that's an issue that just is completely below the radar screen for the most part. And meanwhile, as the caller points out, ordinary people sometimes have a hard time getting an antibiotic prescription. But that's not because necessarily human beings are using too many antibiotics. That's because agribusiness, big farms, have been pushing out small farms and farming on such a scale that the animals are very sick. And so they're applying antibiotics to those animals that gets into our food supply. And that actually is going to reduce the ability of those antibiotics to work for humans in human illnesses. It's an enormous crisis. And we've been looking at that issue in a number of ways.
And so the industry's spinning this. I think that's your way in, right? Is that the people who benefit by this are making it sound like this is not a problem.
That's right. They're basically, in the sludge issue, they're saying that that sludge is not bad for you, that it's fine to apply on farms. And in fact, they've most recently been trying to say it's, quote, organic, with a small O, organic.
Well, if it exists, I guess it's organic.
Yeah,
then by that, all matter is organic,
right,
I guess. So that
the spin master from the San Francisco Public Utility Commission actually said that, it's organic, like in chemistry, organic chemistry, as opposed to inorganic, which is quite a bit of spin. But, there's actually the other way that spin and kind of propaganda happens is, as some of the callers have mentioned and as Bob has mentioned, is by not covering things, by emphasizing other things, by claiming that certain things are safe, and ignoring scientists or citizens who have raised concerns, just not having them be part of the story.
Lisa Grace, let me go to a subject. You've alluded to it earlier, but I think it really gets to a lot of the whole question of spin. We had the BP oil spill fiasco in the Gulf of Mexico this year, which was, unprecedented to my knowledge, anything remotely close to that in human history in terms of destroying our oceans. And what role, it got a lot of coverage, obviously. It was like healthcare. It was one of those stories. It was the dominant story in the news domestically, at least for 4 months, say. What was the nature of that coverage, and what was the spin factor in the BP oil spill?
Well, I would say there are a couple things there. Obviously, it was the biggest sort of environmental disaster to hit the United States. But a couple things happened. One was that there was sort of a news blackout, in the sense that news reporters couldn't get to certain scenes. In some cases, to the actual scene of the spill, they were kept out of those areas. And And then there was this enormous sort of...
To better serve you or not letting you come to the site of the
Not let you see it, I suppose. Unfortunately, with the head Coast Guard guy and one of the agencies that was involved that really was working hand in glove with the deep water oil drillers like BP. And then what we saw was there was this big push by BP to use dispersants. Now, dispersants are toxic. They are toxic in and of themselves. And
what do they do exactly? What is a dispersant supposed to do?
Well, a dispersant has a couple of effects. Its primary effect, if you think about it, like dish soap, which is not this type of dispersant, but dish soap basically removes grease from your pans. And so the idea is that this dispersant would take the oil off of the surface of the water. But what it did was it basically dropped the oil to the bottom of the ocean.
Oh, great.
And so there are studies...
8 miles below or
right,
something.
Right. There are studies coming out of California, or pardon me, out of Florida, the coastal scientists there who've gone down in the deep ocean and seen these big sort of spools of thick oil. It's no longer on the surface, so it's no longer being reported. It's not washing up on our shores, mm-hmm. but it's affecting, undoubtedly affecting the ecosystem of the ocean in terms of the organisms that are down there. Then we heard stories that all the oil had either been, all the oil had either evaporated or been eaten by oil-eating microbes, that the oil was miraculously gone. BP was pushing this story for a while, and basically the reporters have kind of walked away from the whole region. They just think
the story's over now.
The story ended.
Yeah.
But the scientists, thank goodness for the scientists, they're down there actually watching the oil and testing the seafood from some of these parts to find out if this dispersant has gotten into our food supply. And also the workers who were exposed to these dispersants without having any sort of chemical mask to protect them from these dispersants. And the dispersants don't actually eat the oil. They just break it into smaller particles that are then absorbed differently mm-hmm. Into your body or into the cells or the food supply, basically. And so there was a lot of coverage, but then lot of stories repeated over and over.
How much money and resources did BP put into PR? I mean, what was its PR strategy, and how effective was it?
Well, that's a good question. I actually don't know the dollar volume of their PR campaign.
I doubt many people do.
but I know that one of the things they immediately started doing was first buying the Google search terms for the oil industry to basically direct people who were searching for news on the Gulf disaster to their own sites talking about how things were going to be okay.
So basically, when you Google searched anything, the first page, which is where everyone gets all
right.
the stuff from, is going to be stuff they pretty much got there through their work.
Yeah. So,
yeah, that's quite extraordinary.
So they kind of bought access in a way to the top sort of paid hits in Google. And then they started running a bunch of ads. So they ran enormous ad campaign on the major television shows in prime time, talking about how they were responding to the crisis. And then they made, you know, big news about how much money they were supposedly putting into the funds. Well, meanwhile, having talked with some of my colleagues from The Hill, it turns out that the people who were injured in the original explosion are kind of at the bottom of the list of people in the classes seeking recovery mm-hmm. for damages from the Gulf. Hmm. And in fact, the Republicans in the Senate blocked efforts to make sure that those families of oil workers who were killed weren't the last paid. Right. And that bill was blocked to address that concern that had been raised.
Hmm. Our guest today, who you just been listening to, Lisa Graves, head of the Center for Media and Democracy, executive director is the formal title. We've been talking about spin, public relations, its role in our media and our politics for this hour. We've only got a few minutes left. But before we go back to the conversation, just want to, first of all, apologize to a handful of listeners last week who tried to call in when we had a live show with John Nichols. And the phone lines were down, we discovered after the show, and several of you. And I heard from many of you via email, we're not you know, were wondering what was going on. We apologize, but hopefully that will never happen again. We were unaware that the phone lines were being serviced last week. And also, as many of you know, we have sad news. A week and a half, 2 weeks ago, Chalmers Johnson, the political scientist, died, who's been a guest on the show many times for his work on U.S. foreign policy. It's a tremendous loss for all of us. To commemorate Professor Johnson's life and his work and his contributions to WILL and being in the show several times, we're going to air our last interview with Professor Johnson the day after Christmas, December 26th, as we commemorate the show, an interview we conducted in March of this year. We were planning to have him on with his new book, but unfortunately that will not happen now, but we will have this last interview airing on December 26th. So Lisa Graves, we've only got about 4 or 5 minutes left, and we've just literally touched the skimmed the surface of the work of the center and that you're doing and the role of PR in our society. There's one area we haven't talked about at all that I think is a big part of the work now, which is deals with the economy, the bailout, the financial crisis, this whole bankster thing. What is the PR spin angle in on the economic crisis? Why is that a PR issue?
Well, Wall Street has spent a lot of money, basically, and now you see it in the ad campaigns, even these last couple months after the election, about how they're rebuilding our economy. Meanwhile, they've been spending an enormous amount of money trying to thwart financial reforms to prevent the very kind of practices that led our economy down the drain. So on the one hand, you have enormous money being spent in lobbying and in campaign expenditures, in essence, helping people who are not going to be tough on regulating them stay in office, and opposing people who do want to regulate them. And then simultaneously, you have these big ad campaigns about how much money they donated to a charity in town with their profits, talking about how much money they've paid back of the TARP bailout, having gotten kind of 0% interest rates from the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of misinformation going on out there. And then you also have, I think, a lot of misinformation about the deficit, about jobs programs, and what would actually work in our economy. So Mary Batari, who leads our Real Economy Project, has been doing a lot of work both on SourceWatch and on Bankster USA to highlight these issues for people, to try to help support improvements like getting Elizabeth Warren in for the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, working to get the audit of the Fed. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation out there about economic issues, and we are working really hard to try to get the truth out.
Now, I guess one way to put it is that, is it fair to say that any time there's any major political issue in this country that involves large sums of money and potential profits, that it is almost guaranteed there's going to be a massive amount being spent on public relations? Is that sort of like an iron law of American politics?
Yeah, actually, that's a good way of putting it, Bob. They go hand in glove. Yeah.
Yeah, and in this case, we have the financial sector spinning away to try to protect its interests and feather its bed.
That's right. They're both spinning the American people about, you know, what went wrong or what culpability they have. They've been putting out a bunch of stuff through their proxies about how really it's ordinary people who took out too big of mortgages that are to blame, not them.
Yeah, I think I saw him Hannity. That was one of his lines.
Yeah, so they're putting that.
Poor innocent bankers. They were just trying to help grandma get that new home.
Yeah, exactly. The poor bankers routine is out there. That's part of their spin. And their new claims really are on the tax break issue. So,
you know, I hear the band tuning up in the background, Lisa Grace. That means they want to clear me out of the studio for the next show. But we do have a few seconds left. If people want to learn more about the Center for Media and Democracy and the work that you're all doing, what should they do?
Well, go to sourcewatch.org. That's our main flagship site. And also, when you're Googling topics in the news, if you see a SourceWatch hit on that front page, which we often are, you could go to Wikipedia, but then you'll get He Said, She Said. Come to us. Come to SourceWatch. We'll tell you the true story of what's going on.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa Graves. Keep up the great work. Look forward to having you on the show again in the future. I'm Bob McChesney.